feel exactly the same way. And welcome to our listeners. Welcome back to those that catch our show every Friday, 1 to 2. And for those of you that are joining us for the first time, we're sure glad to have you here. And do note that the purpose and intent of the WHFR Journal is really not designed to hit the big international and national hard stories that other stations are bringing to you. We are a local community radio station, and we focus on local community events and activities. Sometimes those have far-reaching capacities, though, and typically they all do. But we certainly also enjoy the opportunity to bring some academic looks at some of the different events that are happening nationally, internationally, globally. What with, for example, what we did last week with your the PRX show, and they do a beautiful job.
Yep, to the best of our knowledge, great show.
Yeah. Public radio stuff is good, and we want to share it as much as we can. But we love having local guests, and we do indeed. One today, so we're very excited.
All right, so let's just sort of like do a reset here. What first program for the month of spring? We always look for those little changes of season, changes of life, things going. And as we know, as we've heard, certainly this week here at Henry Ford College, other big changes on the horizon as well, and then we'll get into the sort of the meat of today's program, I guess.
Yeah, so we did get the note this week that our current president, Russ Cavalluna, has taken another position in Virginia with the community college district there in that Commonwealth, and he is going to be leaving. So we're you know, mixed. I have mixed feelings, and he and I have talked, and it's just, you know, it's sad but exciting, and all of those things. And he feels exactly the same way. You know, I think the mantra of leave a place better than when you got there fits him well, because I think that he has done some wonderful things to keep our school and turn our school in a direction that is going up, up, up. And he'll always support the school, and hopefully we'll get him on sometime.
I was going to say, we've had him on the program a couple of times, and if he wants to leave it better than when he came in, then we're not going to let him off the hook that easy. He's going to have to come back and talk to us again here on the WHFR Journal. All right, so let's dive into it. Obviously, the month of March, a lot of different things going on. We have discussed many of them. Obviously, Women's History Month. There's also Reading Month, if I remember correctly, right?
Mm-hmm. March is National Reading Month, and I know earlier in the month, as I was following and doing some things with classwork, where they start with the Read Across America Day, and then the big read kind of stuff is wonderful, and it's a way to get everybody sort of reading on a certain time at a certain day, sometimes the same book, and programs like that have been going on throughout this month. Earlier this month, Governor Whitmer declared Michigan Reading Month for our own state as well. So in addition to national, it's also Michigan Reading Month. And we didn't want to let that go before the end of the month without addressing it and bringing our own little interesting slant to that. And also, I think it's important to note that when we talk about things going on with reading and campuses and schools opening up and so on, our Henry Ford Library, the Eshelman Library, is open again for people to enjoy. Limited hours, and some services are still online, but welcome back, librarians, to Henry Ford College.
Indeed.
They never left literally, they just left physically for a while. Yeah.
Well, when we talk about reading, obviously, it's all got to start somewhere, and that starts with early education. And you know, as parents ourselves, Susan, you know, I'm fondly probably, you know, now that, I mean, your son is in his early to mid 20s, I'm not going to like put an age on you, but, you know, facts are facts. And, you know, I've got children, in the early 20s or late teens, whatever. We fondly look back on those days where we had the chance to introduce a child to reading and everything that opened up for them. And I guess that kind of leads us to where we're going with this segment on today's program as well. Specifically when it comes to talk about literacy for children and, sort of that in a lot of ways, I mean, both as teachers and as parents, we love seeing those moments of I get it, you know, when things happen. And I think that the, you know, that we all go through that in our own different ways when it comes to, you know, literature and introducing children to the concept of reading. So, let's, I guess start to bring in our guest and maybe find a way to jump into that topic, for this month, for National Reading Month and Michigan Reading Month.
Yeah, one of my favorite classes to take in college was a children's literature class, and I'll tell you the content from this author that we'll introduce here in a moment is on par with some of the best works that I read and experienced in that class. So I am just very excited to welcome renowned author and local Michigander from
Battle Creek. I was going to say Michigan, Michigander.
Jane,
there you go.
Rose Valley is with us. And Jane, we're so excited to have you here. Absolutely love your story of kind of your inspiration from your mother and reading in your bio and how you learned about hard work and commitment and determination. And also that the concept of the arts, you know, incorporating the arts in everything you do with the books that I've viewed that you've created that I've just loved. Not only, I'm a physical book person, of course, got to have it, touch it, feel it, turn the pages, smell the pages. I know that's weird, but it's what I do. And then just be, you know, taken into the story because of the words, but also because of the pictures. So what a beautiful combination you've got here. And it's the passion, I think, Jane, that comes through from that spark that you want to ignite in young readers, which is critically important today. So I welcome you. We welcome you to our airwaves. Look forward to talking about what you're doing now, kind of how you got started. And then also we're going to circle over to a wonderful nonprofit that you founded called Literacy for Kids, which the more I read about it, the more, you know, impressed I am that this exists because of you, because of somebody in our own community. So welcome to our show. So glad to have you here and happy spring.
Thank you so much for inviting me to your show. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, not to build it up too much, but all right. So let's just sort of, I guess, start at the beginning. All right. And we're, you know, as Susan mentioned, an author, children's author, books. Let's sort of start with the process and why you sort of find yourself doing that and kind of where it all begins.
So I'm a mother of three adult children, and we have a daughter who had this crazy, zany, wacky, curly hair. And as a child, she wouldn't let me touch it, comb it, brush it, wash it. I couldn't do anything. And I used to say, Lauren, there could be dinosaurs living in your hair. And I don't really know where that came, except that I have this imagination that's kind of crazy. And it was the most ridiculous thing I could think of. And I suppose I hoped that she would let me get the dinosaurs out of her hair. But to my chagrin, she did not. She would just run out the door and slam it, and I would see her later. So this was a poem I wrote for her. And as Susan mentioned, I grew up with a mom who loved poetry. And often my brothers and I would listen to her, this sing-songy beat rhythm poems that she would just recite that she'd learned as a child. So that was ingrained in me. And I wrote this Dinosaurs Living in My Hair poem for my daughter. And when she was an adult, she said, Mom, I think you should publish this as a children's book. And after several years of dismissing her, finally, it came to be. So Dinosaurs Living in My Hair, the first one was published in 2015. There was a Dinosaurs Living in My Hair 2 and Dinosaurs Living in My Hair 3. We just launched last month. And as you can tell from my titles of 1, 2, and 3, I did not use my imagination other than just to add the numbers. But when I was in classrooms asking what the next title should be, that's what the children asked me to keep the title. So that gives you a brief overview of kind of where we are.
Everyone loves a sequel. And let's just backtrack. So after several years of dismissing you, you dismissed her for a couple of years. And then were able to put it together and make some magic out of it, right?
Correct. So what happened was, as I traveled across the country reading the books, what became very apparent to me was in classrooms with students, with children, it was making such a huge impact on them. I think of myself as just a mom still, not necessarily this author with a cape on the back of me like Superman, but the children saw this author reading to them, paying attention to them, making this eye contact connection, asking questions, listening. And the impact it made on these students was amazing to me. And I kept asking myself, if I am making this little bit of difference, if I could come up with a group of collaborative partners, we could make even a bigger shift. And living in the backyard of Detroit public schools, where their literacy rate is poor, and they score kind of in the lower 8% across the nation, it seemed only fitting that I should be doing more here in my backyard. So in 2018, Heather Mertz, who is our executive director, came on board, and we started to form this Literacy for Kids nonprofit, 501c3 nonprofit. And all of the book sales, I believe in this so much that when I sell a book, everything from an event or selling books, 100% goes into the nonprofit, because I believe that its mission is so important. And as you mentioned about my books and the illustrations and the art, I believe that that's a piece of book writing and literacy that's sometimes overlooked. And reading is not always that much fun for students. Sometimes it's very difficult. So to bring in the art component, a child may say, you can tell a story through pictures, song, dance. There's lots of ways that literacy, I like to stretch it as far as I can. And it's a way to connect, to encourage their curiosity. And anything we can do along those lines, I think, is important.
I think,
well, you're definitely touching a lot of bases for me. My wife, as an art teacher, and somebody who also uses children's literature a lot in introducing her lessons and things like that. It certainly at that age and at that level, it does kind of work, you know, hand in hand. And whether it is either music and words or art and words, or as you mentioned, you know, dance, motion and words and things like that. It's all about what children at that age are experiencing and learning, I would guess. Is that a fair way to put it?
It is. And I like to, probably because of the poetry background, we like to emphasize the beat and the rhythm. So whether you're on a swing and you're swinging back and forth, there's a beat and a rhythm and emotion to that. And we call that poetry as well. So I think it's just really important to, and I think rhymes help kids remember things. And I think that the children really like a beat and a rhythm to a book.
Yeah. So not to put you on the spot, but let's go through some of those rhymes and rhythms. Give me maybe a page or two from one of these dinosaurs living in my hair books, if you don't mind.
That's really
asks the guy who with the bald head, by the way.
I just had they can't see that on the radio, by the way, Susan. Oops. Just so you know. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is each one of the books has a different beat and rhythm. And the counselors teach us how things are connected. The facts about reefs are so cool. When we dive, our fish friends tell us all that they know. This learning is better than school. We discover our oceans need much better care from people who live on the land. The cry for marine life grows louder each day. Please clean up your waste from our sand.
Wow, so there's a lot going on even in those, I don't see it in front of me, but I'd say, you know, basically four sort of rhythm portions, up, down kind of thing. There's a lot going on there. So there's a lot of story here.
Yeah, there is a lot of story. So book three takes us into the oceans and encourages, I think because I grew up with nursery rhymes and the lesson-based books, I tend to do that in my stories, whether it's friendship, bullying, self-esteem, or the latest environmental concerns of the oceans. I think it's important to have a message for students. And we always talk about what is the moral of the story when I'm in a classroom. So the latest one in talking about the oceans, when a child looks out at the ocean and sees just this flat blue surface, it looks empty. And sometimes I think we forget about the fact that underneath that surface is a whole myriad of things that live underneath that. It's their world. And so did millions of things live down there, and they need to be reminded that we need to take care of those creatures, those animals, marine life, plants, and care about that extra world down there.
We're joined this afternoon by author Jane Rose Valley. Her latest book, Dinosaurs Living in My Hair 3, has just come out. It's an underwater adventure and just beautifully presented, both in words and certainly pictures as well, illustrated by Bonnie Helen Hawkins. And Jane, you talked a little bit about the literacy campaign that you've got going with Literacy for Kids. One component that I just love as I'm looking at the brochure, your sort of statement phrase is the art of reading. And that really just so ties in with everything that you're talking about here on the journal today. There are some specific events I know that you are working with, particularly with Detroit area artists and authors. Would you share a little bit about that and other ways that people that are just kind of starting on their own journey of content creation for children or their desire as an instructor of children to incorporate more things related to literacy for reading?
So Literacy for Kids has an Authors in Detroit program. And we have four nationally acclaimed authors that we have on board as our team members right now. We have Kenneth Craigle, who is from Grand Rapids. He is an author illustrator. We have Lisa Klein Ransom, who is from upstate New York. She does chapter books. We have Matt Barnett, who lives in LA. He also does a chapter, he does several books, but we use his fifth, sixth grade chapter type book. And we also have Katie Yamasaki, who is from Rochester, Michigan, but she now lives in Brooklyn. And she is a world-renowned muralist, and she is an author illustrator. And so what she brings to her books is exciting and certainly art-based because she brings her mural background into it, and it's very exciting. So these authors visit the schools. They read to the students. Through COVID, we had their presentations taped because they were not allowed to be in person. And Literacy for Kids purchases a book for each student that is at the presentation. The authors autograph the books. We donate the books to them. And that memorializes this event for them. It's a gift to them that they can remember this event, and it makes it more special. We also have lesson plans for the teachers and activities for the kids so that it doesn't cause extra work for anybody to have this event at their school. In the summertime, we have a creative writing workshop that we do for summer camps. Last year, we were at Center for Success and Detroit PAL, and we work with students to try to teach them how to write a story and have their voice and get their thoughts down on paper in a succinct way.
I love that. I love the fact that you're incorporating, sparking that interest in creating stories versus just reading them and poetry and art in any form. That's some organizations kind of stop at a certain point, and yours clearly continues forward in that aspect of the concept of the art of reading.
What was really interesting last summer, there was a component of it that seemed to get added on that we weren't expecting. And what was interesting is the kids wrote their stories, and they each wanted to stand up and present to the rest of the students around. So there became this leadership public speaking piece that we hadn't even planned on, but they were so proud of what they had accomplished that it was a wonderful addition to a program that we had written that you just never know how things are going to work out.
In a sense, it's kind of like a daughter saying, hey, this is a good story. Maybe you should publish this as a children's book, huh? Right? Yeah, imagine. True. That's you brought something up, and certainly we've talked a lot about this, you know, on this program in particular, talking about school and you know, the challenges that the last 2 years have created. And certainly it's different when, you know, you're only 4 or 5 years old and 2 years of your life is, you know, a third of your life, right? you know, compared to us with a few more laps around the racetrack, I guess. What has it been like and what the program has done in terms of getting back in schools and seeing, you know, kids face to face and as much as that's been able to happen this past year?
It's been incredible to be back in the school system and to be back with students. And I know that if it means so much to me, I can't imagine what it means for students. So wearing a mask is difficult to see facial expressions when I'm presenting to students. I mean, I'm all about facial expressions, so a mask covers up a lot of that, which is difficult for me. It's difficult to hear. It was difficult to hear students. I had to get right in front of their face to be able to hear them and communicate. We're thrilled to be back in the classroom and to have in-person presentations. It's amazing. We're all very excited to be back.
Yeah. You know, I want to jump in. I teach a class called Media Performance, where we learn about working in front of the camera, behind the microphone, and so on. And a lesson that I started doing about 3 years ago, because I was finding that some of our students coming in feeling like they can do these radio voices and this, you know, these things. But the art of the spoken word was not something that many people had skill sets with. And, you know, I'm just thinking about the last poet laureate at the recent presidential inauguration. You know, what a presentation that blew our minds, you know, just brilliant words, whether you agreed with what she said or not, you know, oh my gosh, the way she, it's not what you say, it's how you say it, you know, it is what you say, of course. But so one of the things that we do is I actually teach the students how to read a children's book to a group of students. And it is one of the hardest things for them to do, which is fascinating to me. But I think it's one of those things when you've got it, you've really got it. And I really do feel that some of the artists, the writers, the painters, there's just that extra layer of cool, some confidence of some sort that allows you to be good at so many things, you know, and if just given the opportunity, you'd realize that. So I'm wondering how clearly you talked about how your approach has changed with COVID, but how do you find that it's helpful to share with the students? Now you want to talk like this and you want to, you know, so that make your characters come to life and so on. How much of that is just starting? And if not, let's work on it. Let's get together and do a workshop.
So what was interesting, last summer, again, when we did this creative writing workshop, my niece came in. She's 17. She's a senior this year in Grand Rapids. So we enticed her to come and help us for this week at Center for Success. And I'm sure she preferred to be on the beaches of Michigan, Lake Michigan, but she came and she helped us for a week. And what was interesting was after a day with the students, she was all in. And what she heard from them, and I will always say that whatever you're giving to students, you're getting back. And I find that with Literacy for Kids and with just being an author in a schoolroom, she went back and has changed her focus on what she wants to study in college. She wrote a college essay based on what she learned. And so, again, whatever you think that you're teaching or giving to those students, you truly are getting enormous things back. And I think that for me, I have this kid-like way I think. And so for me to be in a classroom is just, it's the best job you could possibly have.
Yeah. You're clearly in the right place, Jane, and we're very grateful for that. Your third book in the series of Dinosaurs Living in My Hair is beautiful and brilliant, and how tremendously wonderful that all proceeds directly fund Literacy for Kids, the nonprofit that you founded. That's a rare and wonderful thing to be able to say. I will tell you, I love the underwater approach. I'm curious about some of the character names. You incorporate some names of characters that are not necessarily traditional names, and I think that's tremendous. But tell us a little bit about where you are currently finding your inspiration for some of these characters, etc., because I'm sure that, you know, your daughters probably move on, Mom, you know, move, It can't all be about me all the time, but we have some names that are fascinating.
The first book was about, you know, it was Lauren's poem, and it was, you know, and I don't call her Lauren in the book. It's Sabrina. I needed a three-syllable word.
Some sort of, plausible deniability.
In the second book, we talk about bullying, and she goes to school, and there are five of them. And so for the third book, I shifted the focus off Sabrina, and Espuardo is the main character. And I would have people say to me, well, Espuardo's not a name. You can't use that. That's not a name. And I thought, well, people name people all kinds of things. I can name my character whatever I want. So I stuck with it. And so that I kind of just made up. And so I think that you can kind of, as a creative writer, you can kind of stretch those boundaries and have the license to kind of do what you want. So that's how Espuardo got his name.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
I would be remiss in not speaking about the art of the books. And certainly for those listening to us, probably one of the easiest ways to at least get some idea of the visuals for these books, Dinosaurs Living in My Hair, is your website, Jane, which is janerosevalley.com. Although we're just going to have to spell it out, I guess. Jane, J-A-Y-N-E. Rose, R-O-S-E, and then Valley, V-A-L-L-E-E.com. So janerosevalley.com. To look at that, the words are something, the rhythm is something. What has been your approach for finding the illustrators and the artists that sort of bring that vision, you know, your vision to some form of life, almost like a choreographer does for, you know, somebody who's doing a ballet or a dance or things like that?
When I first started out and Lauren challenged me to write the book, I said, well, I don't draw. I'm not artistic, you know, like that. So I cannot illustrate it. However, I did see it in my head. Obviously, I wrote a poem about Lauren. So there was this clear picture in my head. Annie Matzik illustrated the first two books. And when I came across her illustrations and I sent her a note and said, do you work with unpublished authors at that time? And she said, not typically. I sent her the manuscript and she responded. I think I probably was standing by the computer waiting for her response, but she did quickly respond and she said, I'm in. I can see through your words a visual, and she was in and she did an amazing job. Bonnie is from the UK and she did the third book. Underwater, I will say that because I like art so much, and I think it's so important, and the details are so important, all of the illustrations are watercolor paintings. So when I talk to the students about that, I'm like, okay, this is a painting. And when they think about, because they've all used watercolors, they understand that what they're looking at is amazing, creative, tremendous work. And I believe that I am not manufacturing a throwaway book. I'm creating a piece of art. And that's the investment I have made because I think it's that important. Bonnie does the underwater illustrations with the fish that I know are in the coral reefs and the colors, as well as the characters and their expressions and their faces. And she combines all of those things in the third book. So you are right. The illustrations, the art is very important to me, because I don't think any detail is too small, and I wanted to do the best job I could.
I can tell you. Yeah, I was in a coral reef about 10 days ago, and this brought back memories of that experience. I mean, literally, it's that good. Tremendous.
Thank you. The other thing I will add is, if you add dinosaurs to anything you're talking about with children, you can teach them literally anything. So
you captured at least 55-60% of your audience right there. Yeah,
truly have. And I didn't know that going into this, but in hindsight, it was brilliant because you have their attention and they love dinosaurs.
Well done.
Something that I think you kind of touched on earlier, and just sort of looking at the progression of the books and things that we see. And I guess maybe it's just me when talking about, you know, dinosaurs living in my hair being sort of a cultural touch point thing, how much that was in your mind and what that means to different people. I think of the Oscar winning, you know, short a couple of years ago that dealt specifically with, you know, with the concept of hair. If that's anything that sort of comes to you, and how kids are different and hair is different and stuff like that.
So in the first book, and as Lauren grew up, her brothers had very straight hair. Hers was super curly. And all she wanted was to have straight hair like her brothers. And most children want to look like everybody else. They don't want to look different. So the first book celebrates the fact that we are all different. And as the mother holds Sabrina's face in her hands and said, you're perfect just the way you are, that's the message of book one, is all children are perfect just the way they are. And so I think it is important that whether you have straight hair, curly hair, red hair, black hair, brown hair, purple hair, no hair.
No hair. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
it's who you are is much larger than that.
Jane, your mother's inspiration to you is immortalized in the foreword of your book here. It's just very special, and love the photo. And I'm encouraging everybody to support Literacy for Kids. Check out this beautiful book. Check out the series. It is all going to this very powerful nonprofit, literacyforkids.org, if you'd like to learn more. And if you could just speak briefly to those people that maybe have a gift and are a little bit afraid to share it, or have an idea and are a little bit apprehensive to share it, or have a passion for something but don't know how to ignite that passion in other people. Because it sounds like what your mother did for you truly is what has made you who you are today, and has really been the sort of the kickoff point for everything that you're doing to help others. So speak to that just for a moment, if you would. Give us some advice on how we can work our inner creative spirit to be the change.
I think the most important thing that I've realized is there is nothing too big that you can't do. If you would have told me a few years back that I would have founded a nonprofit, a literacy nonprofit, that I would have published 3 books, that I'd be sitting here today speaking with you and your audience, I would have called you crazy. So, I think if you listen to that inner voice, because I think everybody hears it, and sometimes we dismiss it, I think it's important to sometimes listen to it. And don't be, obviously I'm afraid, but don't be afraid. You push past it. If I'm telling children to believe in themselves and to have a voice and to make a difference, be kind, be thoughtful. If I'm telling them that, then I certainly have to live it myself. So probably part of it has been, like I said, if you're in a classroom and you're getting, you know, you're giving to them, they're also giving it back to you. So it's just it's a circle, and listen to that inner voice and trust your instincts. I'm a big believer of trust your instincts.
And it is important to do that. It's also important, even in this day and age, when we have so many other ways of getting information, to be able to read, right? It all starts and begins there. And again, I go back to, you know, sort of where we started out with, you know, the experience of having kids of our own. You know, one of the first activities they get to do on their own once they learn how to do it, is to be able to read and be in their own place with those words, and certainly, obviously, when we talk about early literacy, with the visuals that accompany that as well. And even in this day and age, when there's so many other distractions and different places to go, it all really starts there with that concept of literacy. So once again, literacyforkids.org. Any specific events coming up, or what do you have planned for the rest of the spring here in terms of those?
Well, Literacy for Kids will be at Go Lightly School in Detroit.
Okay.
I think it's about 150 students. Kenneth Craigle is coming from Grand Rapids. Like I mentioned, he's an author illustrator. And so what's fun for the students to have someone who does both, unlike me, who doesn't draw, but Kenneth is great, and he has a book called Green Pants, which is super fun, and the kids will love meeting him. He's great. and we will donate then his Green Pant books to each of those students. So that's happening the end of April. I have some events in the Florida Keys coming up. Probably wasn't the dumbest idea I had to do an underwater book because I do spend a lot of time in Florida promoting it. So I think there was some brilliance there.
Not during hurricane season, though, right?
No, probably not. But
excellent. Well, good luck with that. And obviously, it's been great speaking with you today. Dinosaurs Living in My Hair, one, two, and three, I guess. Jane Rose Valley has been our guest today on the WHFR Journal. Her website, Jane Rose Valley, J-A-Y-N-E for Jane, R-O-S-E for Rose, and then Valley is V-A-L-L-E-E. com for more information about her as an author, and then of course literacyforkids.org, the 501c3. Jane, it's been great to talk to you today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Susan, obviously it's been great to spend time with you today as well. We'll be back with more in just a few minutes here on the WHFR Journal.
The Henry Ford College Learning Lab is your central location for academic support. They strive to assist students and faculty with techniques that are evidence-based and will increase your academic success. The Learning Lab offers in-person and online services to help you succeed. They offer tutorial assistance provided by faculty, professional, and student tutors, one-on-one academic assistance, including strategies for improving test-taking and studying, workshops and presentations to classes or groups on strategies for learning success, study groups and review sessions on a variety of subjects, hands-on learning resources such as anatomical models in our bone room, computers, printing, copying, and scanning. For more information, please visit hfcc.edu/learnlab.
School of the World is a community-driven nonprofit committed to fighting extreme poverty at its core in areas of Guatemala, Honduras, and Panama through the power of education. School of the World works in poverty-stricken communities with little to no access to education to build schools, playgrounds, stock classrooms, educate students, and empower parents to be their child's first educators. Domestic opportunities for students, families, and companies to create change are also available. Please visit schoooftheworld.org for more information or follow them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Pleased to be with you this Friday afternoon here on WHFR Making Waves. We'll be with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Kitty Love comes in at that time, taking us on a trip down Highway 61 to the lands of the blues, local blues, all over the next 2 hours, beginning at 2 o'clock here on WHFR. So we do hope that you will stay tuned for that. All right, continuing with our theme on today's WHFR Journal, talking about literacy and the love of reading. We switch gears and locations a little bit, but stay on the same topic. We're going to listen to a podcast of The Happiness of Reading. Now, after a stint in the United States, molecular biologist Rana Dajani returned to Jordan and noticed that children there didn't read for pleasure. According to her, it wasn't a habit. The literacy rate is high, and everyone knows how to read and write, but nobody was opening a book simply for the joy of it. So for Dajani, that was a problem, who studied the science behind it and found a surprising connection between reading and happiness. So from the Story Exchange, courtesy of the Public Radio Exchange, PRX, we bring you this podcast, The Happiness of Reading, presented by the Story Exchange here on the WHFR Journal.
Welcome to the Story Exchange. You're listening to our series, Good on the Ground.
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 You're listening to Good on the Ground from the Story Exchange, featuring women entrepreneurs making an impact in a world that needs fixing.
We train her, we give her the skills and the tools and examples, and then it's up to her to figure it out. So she becomes a social entrepreneur. Am I going too fast? Am I giving too much detail?
That is Rana Dajani. We asked her to slow down a little.
I'm the founder and director of We Love Reading, a nonprofit organization based in Jordan.
See, that was perfect.
And I'm Colleen DeBase, and you're Sue Williams.
I am indeed.
You know, I have a hard time keeping up with Rana, but not because she talks fast
in two languages, English and Arabic,
but because she is one of these people who can accomplish so much more than the rest of us.
I know. She's amazing. She's a molecular biologist and university professor in Amman, Jordan.
Oh, yeah, I'm a full-fledged scientist. That's still running.
And she is also an entrepreneur running an incredibly unique and growing social enterprise.
Which is all about helping kids read books for the joy of it, not because they have to. Her organization,
We Love Reading,
trains adult volunteers
on how to read aloud in the native tongue on a regular basis within their local community.
We headed to Boston to talk to Rana.
Well, she was a visiting fellow at Radcliffe College.
About why she started We Love Reading.
The surprisingly scientific connection between reading and happiness.
And the butterfly effect of something remarkably simple, taking off and having huge consequences.
Stick around.
So there's a lot of good things coming from reading for pleasure. So that was very clear to me.
So our story begins a few years back.
I did my master's in molecular biology in Jordan. I wanted to be a scientist, right? But there were no PhD programs in Jordan.
In the year 2000, Rana Dajani is pregnant with her fourth child when her husband, Mohammed, encourages her to apply for a Fulbright scholarship.
And she wins it.
I went to University of Iowa. I didn't choose it. It just happened. They sent me to University of Iowa, which is a great school for my field.
She brings the whole family there, spends 5 years in the heartland.
Iowa City has the best education system for children, primary school, all over the U.S. It is the safest place you can be. My kids would come home. I'd stay in the lab till 5. They'd come home at 3 after school, open the door, you know, play outside. It was heaven.
It's not every day you hear Iowa City described as heaven, but to each his own. Anyhow, Rana gets her PhD and returns home to Jordan in 2005.
And that's when she realizes something.
So when you change scenarios, you've been away from a country and you go back, especially for a long time of period, you notice things you hadn't noticed before.
And this is really remarkable.
I noticed when we got back in 2005, looking around me, that children don't read for pleasure, meaning you don't see them, you know, grabbing books and staying up at night.
And it's not just children.
It's also adults. Adults don't read for pleasure, meaning they're not on the bus or waiting in the doctor's office or on the train reading a book. It's not a habit.
Why do you think that is?
This habit doesn't exist not because they don't know how to read. No, everybody's literate. Actually, Jordan has a literacy of 99%. So everybody knows how to read and write. That's not the reason. There are so many people who have lots of books in their houses, and they're very affluent, but they don't read for pleasure because nobody read aloud to them when they were young.
We've been sharing the story of Rana Dajani, founder of We Love Reading.
I want to pick up on something Rana just said. Jordan has an extremely high literacy rate.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
We've profiled social entrepreneurs trying to address literacy issues.
We have, like Stacey Ratner, who runs Open Books in Chicago.
In Chicago, it's really shocking. About 30% of adults need basic literacy training. Here's Stacey.
And when we say basic, we are talking about beginning at the level of difficulty reading the label on a can of food, difficulty filling out a job application, difficulty deciphering a bus schedule.
Stacy runs a used bookstore and hosts literacy programs for kids. You can learn more about her on our site, www.thestoryexchange.org.
But in Jordan, reading and writing isn't the problem.
No, that's not the problem Rana is trying to fix.
As a scientist, Rana was concerned about what happens when kids don't read for the simple joy of it.
Why should we be worried about reading for pleasure? So that was the first question I set out to explore.
She started to research the benefits of just picking up a book.
I found out that reading for pleasure is very important for the following reasons. One, it increases your imagination, right? Broadens it because you're reading about other stories, other places. You learn to empathize because you're learning about other cultures and other people.
Not surprisingly, reading increases your vocabulary,
which has a profound impact as a child matures.
You become better at expressing yourself because you have words to describe your feelings, your emotions, your ideas, your thoughts. And if you have words to describe those, you become less violent.
Keep in mind, Ron is based in the Middle East, where violence can be top of mind.
Mm-hmm. Though, as we unfortunately know, violence is an issue in all countries.
People are violent because they have something inside them they want to share with the world, and they don't know how to. So now having words, you can share it in a much more effective way through writing or speech. So there's a lot of good things coming from reading for pleasure. That was very clear to me. The question that comes after that is, how do you plant that love of reading, right? How do you foster that love of reading?
We'll tell you what Rana came up with after this brief break.
Story Exchange is a nonprofit media company that provides inspiration and information for women entrepreneurs. Check out our videos, including a profile of the entrepreneur you're listening to right now at www.thestoryexchange.org. And we'd love to hear from you, especially if you know someone who should be featured on this podcast. Drop us a line at info@thestoryexchange.org or find us on Facebook.
Again, I went back and I did research, whether it's reading the literature or asking people, the children and the adults, why don't they love to read?
So I think anyone who has children might appreciate this interesting discovery that Rana made.
Especially if you've read Where the Wild Things Are over and over again. I must have read that book about 30,000 times.
I found out that the most important way to make a child love to read is by reading aloud by a parent or a caregiver or somebody close as early as when the mother's pregnant.
That's because the neurons in the brain start figuring out, hey, this reading stuff is very soothing.
There's a connection between the feeling of security and happiness and reading that is reinforced by these neuronal connections. So when you grow up, when you're happy, you want to read. When you're sad, you want to read because it gives you this good feeling. It's coming from that place in your brain that was solidified when you were young. So that's the key. It's reading aloud.
So now that Rana the scientist had it all figured out,
she asked herself one more important question.
We discovered that the way to plant the love of reading is by reading aloud. So I found the key. What do I do? I felt this feeling of responsibility, right? I felt all the future of these children was on my shoulders because I had the solution. I had to do something.
She briefly considered knocking on people's doors.
That's not practical. It's not going to happen.
She really felt, like many social entrepreneurs, that she needed to do her part to fix this problem.
I brainstormed with my husband and my children. What do we do, guys? You know, how do we make this happen?
She decided to take the first step by reading aloud to children in her neighborhood.
We needed a public space that wouldn't be in a house. In Jordan, in every neighborhood, there's a mosque. We said, why don't we use it? It's got a carpet. It's clean. It's empty half the time. It's welcome to everybody. And it's in every neighborhood.
In February 2006... Rana held her first reading in her local mosque.
Do you have a picture of the first one?
Yeah, I do. I could send that with you. With me reading with
Yeah.
Oh, I have all that. I'm a scientist, so I documented everything.
I love the photos we have of her reading to the kids. Now, Rana typically wears a hijab, a veil or headscarf covering her hair. On top of that, she's wearing a large floppy red hat.
With polka dots on it as well.
Yeah, the kids definitely approved.
They fell in love. They fell in love with reading because it was the funny hat. It was the reading aloud in an animated way.
For 3 years, she continued to read to the children every other Saturday morning at the mosque.
Colorful children's books, nothing religious or ideological.
Most importantly, they start begging their parents to read to them, and they read to their siblings and to their friends.
It was an incredibly simple and inexpensive operation.
Rana bought the first 25 books, and then the community began chipping in funds to buy more.
The results were impressive.
The parents told us how their children were doing better in school. They had more confidence. They were off the streets. They were asking for books instead of toys.
Rana kept finessing the model because she wanted to create something that could be replicated at other mosques throughout Jordan.
As I was tinkering with it, I would tell people, why don't you start in your own neighborhood, right? Well, the response I got was, either people don't know how to read aloud because nobody read aloud to them, so they don't know how to do it.
As an academic, Rana was used to applying for grants.
So she decided to raise grant money to start training programs for We Love Reading volunteers.
In 2008, my friend told me, Rana, there's this organization called Synergos that has started a program called Social Arab Innovators. Why don't you apply? So I actually wrote my story. that I just shared with you. And I won the award. And the award was two things. It was financial. I got $34,000. And it was credibility. So now, when I went and knocked on people's doors, they listened to me.
My favorite book is Astro Souls Academy. They got lots of action and they defeat evil people and other stuff.
Today, thanks to Rana's efforts, We Love Reading has trained 4,000 volunteers to read aloud and has worked with an estimated 100,000 children in 36 countries around the world.
Not bad, especially considering she hasn't quit her day job.
Yeah, that's right. She's still a molecular biologist. But Rana has received much recognition for her work with We Love Reading.
The whole region. We thank you.
She's won awards from the United Nations, the World Literacy Foundation, the Clinton Global Initiative.
Rana used that initial $34,000 grant to train volunteers to start their own reading groups.
These volunteers that are reading aloud, we call them the Wheel of Reading Ambassadors. They have become, in their own right, leaders in their community, especially the woman.
Rana used the funds to develop materials and an online training course.
The way it has spread is many ways, but one of them, every person we train, we tell them you have to pay it forward. So you have to train someone else, and you tell that someone else, you have to train someone else. And so it becomes like a domino effect.
And of course, money begets money.
If I would draw a graph, I would show that We Love Reading funding started going up with these small grants. And actually, those grants really helped in formulating and putting a framework of our objectives.
In what might be considered a dream to anyone who has tried to raise money before, either for a startup or a nonprofit or even a project.
In the last 3 years, we were approached by UNICEF saying, Rana, here's $1 million. Do whatever you want.
$1 million. Nice.
Yeah.
Yep. And after that?
USAID offered the Jordanian government a huge grant of $48 million.
To win some of that grant money, We Love Reading partnered with a bigger nonprofit, RTI International.
So we played hard. So we went with the best. And they tell us they won because of us. That got us another like $2 million over 5 years to do our work.
Almost overnight,
We Love Reading went from 2 or 3 employees to an organization with 30.
We have been called a social movement. Because We Love Reading is spreading from person to person through word of mouth. It piggybacks on, you know, a network of human beings who all believe in the same thing. And because the model is so simple, it's flexible, and you can culturally adapt it, and it doesn't need a highly educated person. All you need to do is read a children's book. So it can be implemented anywhere.
ويبدأ اسمي بحرف التاء. من أكون؟
That is the sound of a We Love Reading volunteer who is reading to kids inside the Za'atari refugee camp.
It's a giant camp in Jordan that's home to tens of thousands of Syrians. Half of them are children.
Refugees in camps are waiting listlessly, not knowing where they're going. What is the future holding for them?
Volunteers in the camps, mostly mothers, can follow We Love Reading's simple model to read to their kids.
Suddenly, We Love Reading becomes a very tangible target that they can actually use and implement and feel useful, and that they're planning for the future because they're investing in their children.
In the long term, Rana hopes to figure out a self-sustaining model for We Love Reading that doesn't rely on grants.
In recent years, they've written 32 books, which they sell to generate revenue.
Rana also plans to license the program around the world to much larger nonprofits that are heavily funded, such as Save the Children, which is a $2.1 billion charity.
One of those challenges was, how do I scale We Love Reading around the world? And not just through word of mouth.
She's not overly concerned about the future, though.
Rana believes when you're focused on what's right to do, things fall into place.
Real change takes time, so we're very patient. We know that it's not going to happen overnight. But it's all about planning and thinking forward and having a vision that you believe in, that hopefully we will achieve. So I think that we can change the world through reading aloud. As simple as that.
We thank Rana Jajani for sharing her story.
And we thank you for listening.
I maybe I want to add one thing, if you don't mind. And you can see if you want to.
Yeah.
But what I want to say, what I've discovered through this journey, is that every one of us can can identify challenges in their communities, right? And they can start thinking of solutions. And it all starts with you have to believe in what you're doing. And don't think that you have to change the world. You have to think, what can I do now? And from there, everything just flows. Yeah, so I just want to share. Sorry, you wanted to say something.
You're fantastic. Thank you. Thank you.
This has been The Story Exchange. Join us next time to hear more stories about innovative and inspirational women doing the things you'd never dream of. Or maybe you would. If you like this podcast, please share on social media or post a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And visit our website at thestoryexchange.org, where you'll find news, videos, and tips for women entrepreneurs. And we'd love to hear from you, especially if you know someone who should be featured on this podcast. Drop us a line at info@thestoryexchange.org or find us on Facebook. Sound editing provided by Nusha Balian. Production coordinator is Christina Kelly. Interview recorded by Sam Shin. Executive producers are Sue Williams and Victoria Wong.
All right, The Happiness of Reading, presented by the podcast The Story Exchange here on the WHFR Journal. Another example and beautiful example of the role that reading plays in not only the lives of our children, but in all of our lives as well. Once again, this is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek with you for a few more minutes. Kitty Love comes in at 2 o'clock with Highway 61. Some blues for your Friday afternoon here on WHFR Making Waves. Also online at WHFR.fm. And we're going to wrap up today's program with, I guess at least one more endorsement of the joy of reading. And this one comes from a series called This I Believe, where individuals talk about truly one of the things that means the most of to them in life. And this comes from novelist Rick Moody and his essay talking about believing in the unlimited joy of reading a new book and interpreting its story. Rick Moody, This I Believe, wrapping up today's WHFR Journal.
In his memoir, The Black Veil, Rick Moody writes that in his youthful search for identity, the place he found his one reliable thing, as he calls it, was not in contests for masculinity, prestige, and social standing, but in books. Books made him feel he was good at something. Here is Rick Moody with his essay for This I Believe.
I believe in the absolute and unlimited liberty of reading. I believe in wandering through the stacks and picking out the first thing that strikes me. I believe in choosing books based on the dust jacket. I believe in reading books because others dislike them or find them dangerous. I believe in choosing the hardest book imaginable. I believe in reading up on what others have to say about this difficult book and then making up my own mind. Part of this has to do with Mr. Buxton, who taught me Shakespeare in 10th grade. We were reading Macbeth. Mr. Buxton, who probably had better things to do, nonetheless agreed to meet one night to go over the text line by line. The first thing he did was point out the repetition of motifs, for example, the reversals of things. Fair is foul and foul is fair. Then there was the unsexing of Lady Macbeth and the association in the play of masculinity with violence. What Mr. Buxton didn't tell me was what the play meant. He left the conclusions to me. The situation was much the same with my religious studies teacher in 11th grade, Mr. Flanders, who encouraged me to have my own relationship with the Gospels, and perhaps he quoted Jesus of Nazareth in the process. Therefore speak I to them in parables, because they seeing see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand. High school was followed by college, where I read Umberto Eco's Role of the Reader, in which it said that the reader completes the text, that the text is never finished until it meets this voracious and engaged reader, the open texts, Eco calls them. In college, I read some of the great Europeans and Latin Americans, Borges and Kafka, Genet and Beckett, Artaud, Proust, open texts all. I may not have known why Kafka's Metamorphosis is about a guy who turns into a bug, but I knew that some said cockroach and others European dung beetle. There are those critics, of course, who insist that there are right ways and wrong ways to read every book. No doubt they arrived at these beliefs through their own adventures in the stacks. And these are important questions for philosophers of every stripe. And yet I know only what joy and enthusiasm about reading have taught me in bookstores new and used. I believe there is not now and never will be an authority who can tell me how to interpret, how to read, how to find the pearl of literary meaning in all cases. Nietzsche says, supposing truth is a woman, what then? Supposing the truth is not hard, fast, masculine, simple, direct. You could spend a lifetime thinking about this sentence and making it your own. In just this way, I believe in the freedom to see literature, history, truth, unfolding ahead of me like a book whose spine has just now been cracked.
Rick Moody, with his essay, For This I Believe. We are inviting everyone to write short statements of personal belief. You may visit our website, npr.org, to find information about submitting your writing, and you can also read and listen to all the essays in our series. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Wrapping up today's edition of the WHFR Journal, This I Believe by Rick Moody, talking about the unlimited joy of reading. A great day talking about reading. Let's listen to some music now. Let's use one of the other senses. Kitty Love coming up to take us on a trip down Highway 61 this Friday afternoon. At 89.3, this is WHFR Dearborn, also online at WHFR.fm. Making waves. Happy Friday. See you next week on the WHFR Journal.
Join WHFR on Thursday, April 7th, as we present a benefit concert at Trinity House with Joe Serapere and friends.
Perhaps at Biltmore or the Henry Ford Estate. Hang with industrialists. Pay regards to those ladies.
Dearborn native Joe Serapere performs with some of her musical collaborators, including her band, the La Fondas, at Trinity House on Thursday, April 7th.
You like to rock and roll and spin me round. Pick me up and throw me down.
Tickets are $20 and available through TrinityHouseTheater.org or at the door. Doors open at 7:30 with the show starting at 8. A Radiothon Week benefit concert for the station making waves, WHFR.
Hi, this is Joe Serapere. Join me on April 7th at the Trinity House Theater for a benefit for WHFR Radio.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.